Goebbels was in favor of free speech for views he liked. So was Stalin. If you're in favor of free speech, then you're in favor of freedom of speech precisely for views you despise. Otherwise, you're not in favor of free speech. Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent. Noam Chomsky and the Media, 1992.
G'day world, 333, which means I'm halfway to 666, and you know what that means. The world ends when I get to G'day World 666. That's what was prophesied in the Book of Revelations, my friends. I am the beast with the 12 heads and 12 crowns upon each of my heads. You know it's true, don't fuck with me. My guest today on the show, actor, director, producer, and former commando, Matt Norman from Melbourne. Terrific story Matt's got. He's made a terrific documentary called Salute the Movie. I'm not going to go into it too much here with the intro, but just give you a bit of a background. Go up to the show notes for this episode if you haven't already. You probably won't know the name Peter Norman. He was Matt's uncle. But you'll know this photograph. There's a very famous photograph from the 1968 Olympic Games with three athletes on the podium accepting their gold, silver and bronze medals for the men's 200 metres race. Two of them are Afro-Americans holding their fists up in the black power salute. The third guy getting the silver medal is a white guy, and he was an Australian, Peter Norman. You've never heard of him, and this movie and this show is about why. Hope you enjoy my show with Matt Norman. Coming to us from his hotel room in Melbourne, director, producer, actor Matt Norman. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, mate.
Now, when I was first sent the screener for your new film, Salute, your documentary about your uncle, Peter Norman, I was stunned to discover that the white guy in that famous black salute photo from the 1968 Olympics was actually an Australian. I had no idea. I mean, I had seen the photo, but I had no idea that was an Aussie. And that was, of course, your uncle, Peter Norman.
Yeah, it's been strange for me because growing up with a famous uncle, I've been able to brag about it and say you know that my uncle's the white guy in the Black Power protest photo, and I suppose that's what started the ball rolling in actually wanting to tell his stories, because no one knew that he had a name, and so that was the whole idea. I wanted to get Australians to actually say that's Peter Norman in a Black Power protest photo, because you know he's been classed as the fastest white man in the world, the white guy in the photo. I mean, it kind of goes against the message that they were trying to teach in the first place, and that is that you know, white and black should be the same. Obviously, there's a difference in skin tone, but yeah, no, it's. It seems to shock a lot of people that we've got this Aussie that that still holds an Australian and Commonwealth record, but an Aussie that actually came second in the Olympic Games.
Now, my guess is that one of the reasons most of us don't know his name and didn't even realise he was an Aussie is because he was ostracised and his actions were ostracised by the Australian media at the time.
Yeah, you know, I think the one problem that we had, like most of the world did at that time, was Australia was known as a racist country, and back in the '60s, and
mate, it still is.
Yeah, well, that seems to be the issue now. And it's so obvious 40 years later we're going through the exact same problems as what Pete did back then. But, you know, it was not the coolest thing to do to stand up for Black America. And when he came home, that transferred over to Black Australia. And again, you know, we had Aboriginals voting for the first time in 1969. So, you know, 68 wasn't the best year to be standing up for the black man. And that's what Peter did.
A lot of people listening to this are probably going to be too young to remember the internet. I was born in 1970. So whilst I've seen the photo, it's obviously one of those iconic human rights photos from the 60s.
Yep.
I don't really, until I started to research for the interview, I didn't understand a lot about the background. Why don't you give people just a quick overview of the episode and what happened?
Okay, well, obviously 1968 was the Mexico City Olympic Games, and Mexico was going through its own issues with student protests. And the student protests were related to why their government would bring an Olympic Games to a country like Mexico and spend millions of dollars building it up for an Olympic Games and not put money into the poor people of the country. You know, there were slums right around the area that Olympics were going up, so a lot of the athletes were hidden. So there was already some political problems over there, and then for the fact that you know, nearly 2,000 students were shot from helicopter gunships and on the streets by the Mexican government soldiers, that caused obviously a horrific massacre that still is in the courts today, because the government there are saying that, you know, a few people had died. But, you know, some people are still in prison over there for protesting against Mexico. So it started out bad. We had the Vietnam War going on at the same time. We had Martin Luther King assassinated and Robert Kennedy assassination. So 68 was a hell of a year. And one of the things that started the proposed boycott from Black America was in 1967 they decided to boycott the Olympics, all black nations. Then they realised that some wanted to and some didn't want to. So it got to a stage then that, you know, Harry Edwards, who was the instigator of a lot of it, he said, okay, well, you can actually demonstrate in your own way instead of as a team or as a race of people. And so that's what started the Black Power protest, was that Tommy and John, and also Peter obviously, but Tommy and John decided to make a stand. There was a few other opportunities to do so and no one did it. Tommy and John said, well, this is our time to do it, and they were the first. So they certainly got the recognition of the media straight up when they went out to the podium after the 200 metres to receive their medals. They stood on the dais, and as the flags were rising, they bowed their heads and put their black glove fists to the sky. So in demonstration on how African Americans, you know, they can be sent to war as cannon fodder for the American people, and be heroes. They can go and win gold medals at the Olympic Games and be heroes, but as soon as they come home, they're treated as nobody, as scum, is what they say. So the Black Power protest in itself was silent, but heard around the world, which was interesting. It became the year that politics and sport truly mixed. Because they took an opportunity and you know, that photo itself is in the top three of the 20th century. So, you know, it was a big gesture to make. And, you know, I just like the fact that it wasn't violent. It didn't represent violence, but it was a statement that they made.
And your uncle, excuse me, your uncle Peter stood there, didn't raise his fist, but he was wearing a human rights badge, I believe. Was it the OPHR badge?
That's correct, Olympic Project for Human Rights. A lot of people didn't actually know that fact, which, again, was quite amazing to me. But in the photo, you can see that he's wearing a big white badge. But a lot of people didn't actually get the fact that Peter was involved in that protest by saying, you know, I believe in human rights. I'll wear this badge in support. I won't put a fist in the sky because that's kind of going against what they wanted. So it was only discussed under the podium before they walked out to receive their medals that was what they were going to do. John forgot his gloves, left them in the Olympic Village, and Tommy said to John that he was still going to do it. And so Peter actually said to them, why don't you wear one glove each? Because there's only one hand going up. And so that's what they did. So, you know, Peter helped instigate the wearing of the gloves as well, which a lot of people have never been told.
And all three athletes, Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and your uncle Peter Norman, when they were booed for a start when they walked down off of the podium, I believe, by the people at the stadium. And then there was outrage, and they were ostracised, not just by the media in their respective countries, but also by their Olympic committees. I know that Peter wasn't selected for the 1972 Olympics, even though he came third in the trials.
Yeah, see, the horrific thing that most people are stunned by in this film is finally we get to say what really happened in that time. And the one thing that is really strong is that when they came off the podium, they just got boos and jeers from the crowd. Tommy and John were then sent home by by Avery Brundage, who was a racist. He was the boss of the Olympics of the IOC that year. And so they got sent home and banned from Olympics for life. Peter got reprimanded, but in a very Aussie way. The head of the Australian team, Judy Patching, said, consider yourself severely reprimanded. Here's some tickets for the hockey. But Peter and Judy were good friends, so I kind of expected that. But as soon as Peter got home, that was it. The other officials, even though Peter qualified for the 100 and 200 metres during that year, the qualifying year for Munich in 72, he qualified, 10 times for the 100 and 10 times for the 200 metres during that year. And still, the selector said, we're not taking you because of your misbehaviour at the last Olympics. And it was the first year ever that no Australians were taken to Munich for any of the track, sprints. So it was not only a case of Peter not going, but no one went from our country. So if anyone was to go, it was going to be Peter.
Hmm. And, of course, this is very relevant at the moment because of the unrest surrounding the Beijing Olympics and the fact that a number of Australian athletes, I believe, would like to protest China's treatment of Tibet, but they have been threatened. You know, it's like 40 years later, and they're still not supposed to make any kind of political statement at the Olympics, which is just, in my opinion, blatantly ridiculous.
I couldn't agree more. I think Australia now are turning into a police state, where I just heard that Yemen has said that you're not allowed to even wear T-shirts as public to any of these things like Youth Day and you know, gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, and you're not allowed to wear T-shirts that are political. And I'm sorry, but I'm an Aussie, and if I want to wear a T-shirt, I'll do it. So I actually would suggest to all your listeners that they go out in force and wear the harshest T-shirts possible and then just say that Matt Norman said that we can, so that I can actually take the blame, so that I can make it public that Australia now lives in a police state. In regard to Beijing, I am incredibly horrified with the approach that our own Australian sporting committees have made against Beijing and against the athletes, and that is that it's been a bit of trickery, to be honest. You know, first of all, they said that our athletes cannot protest in any way or else they'll be dispelled from the games. Then when it got out really media-wise that Kevin Rudd had meetings and also said, you know, there's some issues that are related to China's civil rights, etc., that need to be addressed. As soon as that happened, that pretty much opened the gates for the sporting commissions here to say you're allowed to protest, but if you do, there's what's called a Section 51 in their contract that says if you protest or do anything to harm the reputation of the Australian team or the Olympic Games, that you won't get any money for any winnings. Because they actually do make money if they win gold, silver or bronze.
Do they really? So, I had no idea about that.
Yeah, so in other words, you're allowed to protest, but we're going to make sure that you don't get paid. And that, to me, isn't just another gag order, and they've just hidden it under the old contracts that the athletes have to sign. The other thing is, too, I'm kind of curious on why they believe that our athletes shouldn't attend the opening ceremony. Now, I don't know about you, mate, but as far as I'm concerned, if I was an Olympian, going to an Olympic Games, I wouldn't miss a second of any part of the Olympic Games, especially the opening ceremony where you're meant to be walking out behind your flag to represent the country. They're using the excuse of it's too smoggy to walk out onto a the area. And to me, I'm thinking, hang on a second, they're walking out to the inside the track to promote Australia, but then they're going to run through this smog for the rest of the Olympics. So it makes absolutely no sense. So I think what they need to do is start coming up with a much better story, because I don't think we're stupid. You know, I think the issues that are related to Beijing at the moment are being misreported as well. I mean, I met with the Dalai Lama 2 weeks ago, and I'm certainly speaking out on in regard to the Australian Tibetan Association and helping get the word out about what issues there really are over there. And the issue is this, that the one thing that has to be made really clear is that the Chinese government should be really proud of themselves. You know, they've actually managed to bring 400 million people out of poverty. So, you know, all credit to the Chinese government for that. If you noticed during the earthquake recently, the Chinese government made very quick decisions to get the army in to help out. And again, that's worth applauding, because let's have a look at George Bush during the New Orleans disaster. You know, they couldn't even get a bus in to go and help African American people get out of their own country or of their own state during that disaster. So Beijing have, the Chinese government have got something to be really proud of. This is their opportunity to show the world that they are a great country. And that is, if they stand up and say, you know what, I think it's time for change. You know, change is meant to happen over generations, because we're learning from our mistakes, just as, you know, Kevin Rudd did on the Sorry campaign. I think that was a unique opportunity that was taken, and it's going to help. I don't think it has yet, but I think it's going to help move things forward with our own Indigenous people and the plight that they've had for so many years. Unfortunately, China is still not even, you know, I know that they've had talks with the Dalai Lama in the past week and things seem to be moving forward, but the civil and human rights injustices that are happening inside China are you know, incredible to say the least. You know, these, they've had a very long list of injustices happen in that country. And I think for us to help promote China as a Olympic state where all countries of the world are joining together for harmony, I just think that's kind of a joke. It's kind of backwards. And as an Aussie, I'm humiliated by the fact that, you know, it's like giving a giving a razor blade to a child, to be honest.
I want to talk to you about your experience with the mainstream media and these sorts of issues. You know, obviously, the mainstream media can be a great force for change or a great force for conservatism on these sorts of issues. And obviously, you've had some direct experience this both with the way that your uncle was treated after the 1968 Olympics. And you yourself, you're an actor, you're a filmmaker, you're obviously doing a lot of media at the moment to support the film. What kind of attitudes are you getting from the mainstream media about the issue of athletes and whether or not they should protest at the Olympics? Do you find that the mainstream media is supporting the fact that they should have the right to speak their mind? Or are they on the side that the Olympics should shut up and just run?
I can honestly tell you that the media have been of the same opinion as myself. I think you'll find that a lot of the media have been shocked with what I'm saying because I'm actually saying it. There doesn't seem to be that many people that stand up anymore. You know, does it go against my own aspirations and career as a filmmaker? Yes, it does because, you know, it's, you know, I've got funding from federal government. Etc. So does that really hurt? I can't see that it's going to hurt a thing because sometimes you've got to stand up for what you believe no matter what the consequence. Now, I lost everything making this film. When my uncle died, that's when I got funding, which is kind of typical because, you know, I was going for funding before he died and no one wanted to know who Peter Norman was and no one really cared. But obviously, there was a great opportunity to make a ridiculous amount of money with a story, with the only story left on earth about this incident from all three people. So everyone wanted to, you know, put money in and say how wonderful the film is. I've been a bit annoyed about that because, you know, I went for funding a long time ago and didn't get it.
We should point out that you started making the film in 2002, I think, and
that's correct.
Your uncle passed away in 2006.
Yeah, so I'd been starting the film, trips to America to do it were all off the, you know, I was getting sponsorships and things like that and a lot of help. And all the way through that process, not one person wanted to put their hand up to say, you know, this is worth telling. But pretty much after Peter died, I only got funding this year to finish the film onto 35mm, and you know it's a rather large budget. But I kind of found that a little bit inadequate, to be honest, because all this time I've been pushing this film, everyone just thought, no, we don't need to know. Who wants to know about Peter Norman? Who wants to know about this Olympic message? You know, we've got Olympics coming up and all that sort of thing. And I find that a little bit disheartening for our own film industry that, you know, I was an unknown. I'd made four dramas that have won international acclaim, but to actually get a film up in this country is like, it's like going back to primary school, hanging out with the good guys, and then when finally you become the leader, then they drop you because you've got to go to high school.
Was Andrew Mackey part of the funding that you got or the distribution?
Was the what, sorry?
Andrew Mackey, was he part of the funding or distribution deal that you got?
I wish he was part of the funding. Andrew Mackey, who was from Dendy, now Transmission Films, he is the, he's one of the distributors that brought on Paramount Pictures. And I have to say, Andrew Mackey and Richard Payton saw this film before it was completed, and they said, this has to be told. This story has to get out. They worked incredibly hard to make sure that the right people saw it so that it had mass appeal. To actually get Paramount Pictures is just an absolute coup for Peter. I made a promise to Pete before he died that, you know, my job was to see him recognised as an athlete and as a humanitarian. I never expected this to be picked up by such a huge company as Paramount. But I can say that Andrew Mackie did have a very big part to it. He only came on around the start of the year, but was obviously going through his own issues with Dendy Films, which was bought by Icon. So he wanted to hold on to this project until he started his own, a new distribution company with Richard. Once that happened, they jumped on immediately, did a deal through Paramount, which is one of their sister companies that they deal with a lot now in Australia, and here we are now. So Andrew, you know, people like Andrew Mackie and Richard Paton in Australia are daring to take a ridiculous risk, you know, with this country falling on its face because of, you know, issues relating to kind of bad films that we seem to be putting out. And it's not necessarily all of them. It's just that, you know, the Australian industry still is the mates club. And you'll notice that every film that comes out of Australia is by the same people. I don't understand that. I think there are so many unique and incredible independent filmmakers in Australia that are never going to see a dollar because, you know, this boys club that seems to be presented to us as, you know, these people have got experience so they deserve the money is absolutely ridiculous to me. You know, I went and got, you know, Oscar-nominated people in my crew. I did everything off my own bat, and I only got recognition once Peter had died and they saw an opportunity to tell a unique story, which it's always been unique. It's just that, you know, the powers that be decided now is the time to strike because we've got Olympics coming up. This is the last time Peter's been interviewed, and it's the true story of what happened and not what people think happened. So I was really lucky. I got funding, and but mainly because I had, you know, to get funding, you have to have a distributor. So that's where Andrew Mackie and Richard Paton came in because we needed them to get funding, and they, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, knew that this was a risk. Having a documentary released cinematically in Australia was a huge risk, but they saw the film and they both cried. It seems to be an emotional overtone on this film is that there's no dry eyes in the house when people leave. And they saw that and went hell for leather, to be honest, to make sure that this was seen by the masses instead of just a couple of cinemas. You know, we're at 19 cinemas now, including the big ones as well. So, you know, Village came on, Dendy Cinemas, Palace Cinemas. So we're in a really good position now to promote this to all Australians who should go and see it.
Yeah, Andrew Mackie, I've been a big fan of for many years. He was a very big supporter of this show when it started a few years ago, and he's phoned in reports from Cannes Film Festival for us a few times. He's a big supporter of all sorts of media in this country. He's a terrific bloke.
You know what? It doesn't surprise me. And the thing that I've found in the last 8 years that I've been director-producer is that there is no one in this industry that actually stands up for the little guys. Now, I consider myself one of the little guys because, you know, there's so many other films being made that I'm trying to get up. I can't see I'm having any problems now getting a film up. And it's not necessarily because I'm now considered one of the boys' club, because I don't think I'll ever be and don't want to be. I consider the projects that I do as unique. Uniquely Australian, I suppose, is the best way to say it, in that I'm not going to do comedy. I will never, ever do a comedy because I think it makes Australians look stupid. Our days of comedies back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we've had the Castle, we've had those sort of movies that I think were fantastic at the time. I loved them to death. But now I think it's time that Australians started making serious drama. You know, take New Zealand, for example. They don't take the piss out of themselves. They're doing things like In My Father's Den and Rain and Whale Rider and things like that, that are just stunning portrayals of their own country. Instead of, you know, the most we could do is like The Tracker, Rabbit Proof Fence. They're the sort of films that I think we need to start making more of, instead of continual, very low budget comedies. And although I love comedians in this country, it does seem to me that a lot of the funding now, if you're a comedian, get into the film business, because you're more than likely going to get your film up rather than a drama. So I just think it's time that comedies get sort of shifted back a little, so that we start talking about real issues in our country with international appeal.
And I believe that your next project is to make a dramatic version of these events. The film's called 1968, and I read on your website that you were in discussions with Heath Ledger to play the role of Peter before he tragically passed away.
Yeah, that day that Heath died was a real shock, and my wife and I actually saw it on TV early in the morning, and I was just watching it in bed, and I was just absolutely horrified that such an incredible talent in Heath Ledger, as you'll see in the new Batman, he has just got an amazing charisma. And I think, you know, he was we were in talks with him in regard to playing Peter on the dramatic version. He absolutely loved the Aussie style of Peter, and you know, his look was exactly the same as Peter when he was younger too. So he was the perfect choice. You know, obviously this film's going to be a rather ambitious budget, but I'm not expecting any sort of favours from our own country. I'll more than likely have to take this to the States, where I know I'm already being offered opportunity over there to make this, because the good thing is we have an Australian Farlap as a runner, you know, and the Americans love the fact that this is actually an American story about an Aussie. So I know that I'm fielding offers now to help out. I'm going to produce and direct, because I'm the only one that actually knows this back to front. I mean, I've been studying this and researching this all my life, but in the last 6 years, I've actually gone through and found stuff that I didn't think I was going to find. So people know that I know the story backwards. I work with actors incredibly well, and I want to make a drama film that's not Hollywood. I want to make a drama film that's very edgy and political, and also makes people aware of a lot of the things that I haven't put in the film. So, you know, the opportunities now that, you know, I'm starting to speak to A-listers in the States that are, you know, it seems to me that it's kind of easy or easier, knowing that I've got the film Salute to show them and say, this is the film I'm going to do as a drama. African Americans in the States absolutely loved Peter. And the high-end A-list actors, the Will Smiths and the Denzel Washingtons and Jamie Foxes and people like that, they all know who Peter Norman is, just like most Americans do. It's unfortunate it's not the same here, but you know, to get them involved in a black civil rights film, which it was pretty much known as the grandfather civil rights film, apart from the Malcolm X's and all those sort of films, it became, you know, this was the symbol of civil rights for African Americans. And I know that Denzel Washington puts this picture in most of his films that he does. He just puts it in the background somewhere. So getting the A-listers has been a little bit easy because of the actual photograph and the knowledge that they have of the race and the respect they have for Peter and Tommy and John. So, you know, it was a shame that we as Australians actually lost one of our greatest actors, and you know, at such a disgustingly young age, and it's, you know, it's something that we're having to deal with, and it's been very hard, to be honest, to think of someone else to play Pete, because, you know, from years ago I've had him in my mind as the perfect Peter Norman. But, you know, I think his legend will live on in especially things like Brokeback Mountain and Batman. I think, you know, Australia's about to certainly be unleashed with the great loss that we've had in such a good actor. So in regard to the film 1968, which is what it's called, we're just pushing forward. Sorry, that's Hollywood, mate. Hang on. And I obviously owe you a slab of beer. We're going to push forward with 1968. I'm actually hoping, ambitiously, of course, that this gets made sometime next year, late next year. We're working on a script as we speak, and getting enough people to like the story of Salute. I think that's our main objective, is to really push Salute so that the backstory is there. I'm getting, obviously, assistance from people like Andrew Mackie and Richard Payton, who, you know, obviously love this story. So the assistance is there. I'm certainly getting the recognition for the story. And as a filmmaker, that seems to be, you know, that I'm the choice of choices if it comes to making this film. So, you know, I'm getting the support I really need at this stage. And whether I get the Australian support, I'm not really that concerned, to be honest.
Well, mate, good luck with that. And I do urge everyone to see Salute. It's an incredibly powerful film and an incredibly important story. In more ways than one, but particularly with this whole idea, as you said earlier on, standing up for what you believe in and using every opportunity that you have to get your message out to, you know, the rest of the world. And I think that's the opportunity athletes have. They get a brief moment of global recognition at something like the Olympic Games, and if they want to, they can use that to spread a message, as your uncle so powerfully did in 1968. Congratulations on the film, and best of luck for 1968, mate.
Thank you, mate, and make sure that everyone's wearing a nice T-shirt that's as political as it can be.
Oh, by the way, something else I read too. You've got two kids called Hunter and Riley. You've got four kids, but...
Yeah, I've got five, actually.
But,
well, yeah, one to another relationship that I haven't seen in 4 years. There's a doco in itself.
Well, I've got twin boys, and one of them's name is Hunter Riley.
You're kidding.
No, there you go.
I'll tell you what, they must be very attractive.
They are, and he was named after Hunter S. Thompson. Was yours named after Hunter S. Thompson?
No.
Oh, okay.
Now, my Hunter was actually named after, you'll really hate this, but, you know, I'm ex-Special Forces Army, and everyone thought, well, you know, Hunter was a very strong military-style name. But it wasn't. It was from The Bold and the Beautiful. I just loved the woman, Hunter Tyler, and I just I was in love with her when I was growing up. And I just love that name.
Well, I've got twin boys. One's Hunter, the other's called Taylor.
Oh.
And when we first named the kids that, everyone said, oh, you must have named it after The Bold and the Beautiful. And we were both like, what? We had no idea. So
well, there you go. So that's from now on, if kids want to, if parents want to name their kids, they should just follow our direction and look at The Bold and the Beautiful.
We've got it all sorted. When were you involved in the Special Forces? You've been acting for a long time.
Yeah, back in very early 90s. But I've been acting since 95, which is, you know, it's obviously a huge change. there seems to be a lot of change in, you know, where I've come from to where I am. You know, I started as an extra and then got into acting because I was looking at some of the actors thinking, you know, I can do that. And started getting gigs. Went to in National Theatre Drama School in Melbourne for a year. Got kicked out after a year because I don't think I conformed well to old style acting methods. I wanted to be a little brash, and I made a really good living out of being an actor. And you know, I've worked with Gregory Peck and Nicolas Cage and Patrick Stewart and Ted Levine. I've worked with some of the great Americans and also pretty much every Aussie there's ever been on television. So you know, for me, it was a really good move into writing and directing film. I kind of feel that you've got a shelf life as an actor in this country because, you know, we're pumping out so many hundreds of thousands of actors in this country all the time, and 1% of people are getting work. And I just thought, you know, I've got a family now. I need to actually start being a little bit more anal about how I make my money and also how I tell my stories. So instead of telling other people's stories as an actor, I thought, well, you know, we need to actually get something serious out. So that's what I've been doing. You know, some of the things, some of the films that I've written have very topical things. You know, one is called Stillborn Bastards, which is about two women that were raped in Bosnia throughout the war by hundreds of Serbian soldiers, locked into a car park for 2 years, had a child, which was classed as a bastard child, and then sent home to their families. So that's one film that I'm doing.
Nice. Heartwarming stuff.
Well, it is. And look, the other one is, which I won't give any details out because of security reasons, but one's coming up shortly in Afghanistan. And that's going to be, that'll be a civil rights doco. And it's directly inside Kabul. So that's a bit risky, so I won't discuss dates and times, but, yeah, that's coming up, shortly, just for me to get my, teeth back into something while I'm promoting Salute.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, mate, you'll have to come back on and tell us more about it. Congratulations.
I'll come on any time you want me on.
All right. Well, I'll hold you to that. Matt Norman, good luck, mate.
Thank you, buddy.